talk a bit about your first time in the field. You went from being on the Nuasis, I believe, to then going out into the field. Was that a dramatic change?
Well, we were all crowded into a little boat. Everybody was just packed with weight. I mean, the things that people carry out into the field is just unbelievable. And I wasn't. So right off the bat, I felt completely conspicuous. I mean, I had two bags. I had my backpack that had all, you know, clothes and all my personal stuff in it. And then I had my Bennick bag. And my Bennick bag was packed, I mean, doubly packed with a bunch of stuff. So it wasn't like I didn't have stuff to carry, but I didn't have a weapon and grenades and ammunition and, you know, all that stuff. I was carrying extra socks and I had extra water and I was sort of walking along as this little infirmary. So right off the bat, I felt different. And I caught these guys who I didn't know. I'd never met the people in my platoon. The only one I knew was my sergeant, who was the other medic. And so right off the bat, I was very conscious that there were a lot of eyes on me. And as soon as we had our first casualty and I actually performed my job as a medic, all that changed. Then everybody knew my name and everybody was sharing stuff with me and talking, and, you know, then I was in. But that wasn't until I proved that I had a reason to be there and that was okay. And no one ever asked me about the weapon thing, except my sergeant, except a fellow medic. He mentioned it, but no one ever mentioned it. It just didn't come up. You know, a lot of medics never use their weapon. And in some cases, it's just in the way. I've heard from other medics that they gave up their M16 and carried only a handgun and put it on a holster because they were so busy. Their hands were busy and they didn't have... If they laid it down somewhere and then had to carry somebody somewhere, they'd have to go back and find their weapon, or someone else would have to carry it for them, and then they'd have to carry all the ammunition for it. And it was just it was a hassle because that wasn't their job and they didn't need to do that. Now, that's Southern. Remember, there's kind of two wars in Vietnam. There's the Southern Mekong Delta guerrilla war, where everything was search and destroy missions, where you go out looking for the guerrillas. In the North, that was a more traditional battle. I mean, this was an air battle and tanks and lines and the Vietnamese regulars coming down and taking over an area and a hill or something, and then our guys going out. And I wasn't there. I wasn't in the North. And a lot of what I say is from my experience in a war that was really different from the war that people fought up in around the DMZ and up there in China Beach and places like that.
But the part you participated in a lot of ways is similar, again, to what people are experiencing in Iraq, is my impression.
Oh, yeah. In a lot of ways, a more urban way. They're going house to house and they're seeking out places where people are hiding arms or hiding, you know, where the enemy is. And you know, history just repeats itself. One of the things that I believed in the Vietnam War coming out of that, and I actually it was in my book at one point, and I don't know if it's, I think it's still in there, a little bit of it's in there, but not the whole thing. But there, you know, this guy Che Guevara, who helped Castro do the overthrow of Cuba, well, he took his show down to Bolivia, and there's a book, Che, you know, that about this. And I think our military, the people who are the strategists when it comes into an insurrection like this, ought to read Che's book. They ought to read that before they read Patton or Rommel. They should read about Che, because the very thing that won him Cuba lost him Bolivia. He went to Bolivia and they didn't want his show. And they gave him up. I mean, the populace did not support Che's talk, his communism talk of the power of the people and take over the government. And I think, I'm not really sure about this because it's too long ago, I can't remember. I think our CIA helped, or they did it themselves or something, but they took him out. I mean, the people told him right where he was, and it wasn't a problem. I mean, once he got to Bolivia, it wasn't a problem to go find him and take him out. Well, history just repeats itself. I mean, Nicaragua, same thing. El Salvador, same thing. When you're working against the populace, against the people, and if you try to use a traditional war, if you go hand-to-hand out there in combat, you're working with people in their neighborhood. And you're working with, maybe there are only, Well, I mean, think about our neighborhood. Think about where you live. Well, there may only be 10 teenagers out there who would actually go and do the fighting. I think in northern Italy, I think there's also, northern Ireland, there are all sorts of examples of this. So let's say 10 people in your neighborhood are actually the insurrection. You know, they're the ones who are fighting. Well, they come to your back door and want food, or they want to hide in your garage. Who are you going to support? The people who you grew up with, who live in your neighborhood? Or these people from a foreign country who come in and don't look like you, don't talk like you, don't know anything about you, don't speak your language, don't know your religion, don't know what's sacred, do nothing but disrespect you and take you outside and shake you down every time they come by the neighborhood and treat you like you're the enemy? Well, who are you going to help? It's not rocket science to figure that out. So what do I think about Iraq? I think we're fighting the whole country, one way or the other. And the way we picture them is that there's these few radicals who are holding on to this old regime. Well, the parallel to that would be if someone attacked America and the only people defending us were the KKK or the Aryan Nation, you know, would we support the KKK in fighting? I don't think so. That's different. Those aren't our neighbors who we grew up with. These are radicals out there. And we would probably point them out and say, yeah, take them out. We don't like these guys. They always were nuts, and they embarrass us. It wouldn't take long to find who they were, where they are, and take them out. Now, this, you know, I can just imagine some military person listen to this and say, oh, he's so naive. But maybe we need to be a little more naive. Maybe we need to just look at it for what it is. From what I hear from the veterans who are talking to their veterans, I belong to Veterans for Peace, I don't mean veterans, but active duty people who are talking to their parents and who were seeing their letters come home, and it's not that they're being disloyal. It's not that they're not doing their job. It's not that they're not hoping that they can finish in Iraq, do a good job, restore the country to the Iraqis, and get out of there. It's not that they don't hate what was going on there before, but when they talk about the war right now, today, it sounds like the common denominator is this is way, way more than we thought it would be. This is the whole population. This is not a small group of terrorists or of, you know, like what we would call radical fanatics, like the skinheads or something. This is not that. This is the whole population who, when they are polite to us, it's because they fear us. It's not because they respect or they want us to help them. It's because they fear, if they're not respectful, that we will literally kill them.
A lot of people have pointed to the similarities between Vietnam and the situation in Iraq. Do you think that's a fair comparison between the two?
Yeah, I just made it. You know, I just leaped off of Vietnam and got right to it. Yeah, I think that history is repeating itself. The one hope that most Vietnam veterans had, whether they were doves or hawks or liked the war or hated the war, was that we learned a lesson there that wouldn't be repeated. And for that reason, I'm sick to my stomach. It means that all of those people, those 58 plus thousand who died in Vietnam, to me, and now we've just disrespected what we learned there because we have gotten right back into the same thing. We got there on a big lie. We're staying there on bigger lies. Same thing that happened in Vietnam. A lot of people said this was the first time that we ever had a war that we started. Not true. I think the Gulf of Tonkin lie is right up there with wars that we started based on a lie rather than the truth. So we're right back at it again.
In addition to yourself, the other main character in the book is a guy named Smitty, who the reader just falls in love with. He's just the perfect buddy. Can you talk about him?
Yeah, Smitty was a lifer, Mississippi, came from very poor family. Their family lived literally right on the Mississippi River. Didn't talk much about his family growing up. I got the idea that he was left home pretty early. He had been a Marine for a number of years, probably 10 years, I think, then had done a couple hitches in Vietnam, and his entire platoon was wiped out in a battle in the north, and he was injured severely, one of the few survivors of this just being overrun, and was shipped out, shipped home, and he was so badly beat up that the Marines just released him. He'd been in the service all his life, literally all his adult life, and they discharged him, gave him a medical discharge, and he couldn't argue with it. He went back to Mississippi, was there for 6 or 8 months, I think, and just couldn't stand it. I mean, he was married, he had a wife at home and all, and but she agreed with him that he needed to be back in Vietnam. And so he went to the Army recruiter and said, here, I have these 10 years behind me, or 10 or 12, I can't remember exactly how many it was, and he said, can I get in the Army? And the recruiter said if he could pass the physical test, he could get in. He passed with flying colors. He said something about, I limped my way around the 2-mile run and did it better than the first time I had done it in the service, because he was in such great shape. And he had recovered. You know, he was a guy that lift weights and do everything he could to get himself back in physical shape. But he was a gunnery sergeant or something in the Marines. He was not a medic. And he had acted as a medic when he was in the Marine. There were times, he said, where we just didn't have enough corpsmen. And I liked that. So when he went into the Army and he was able to choose his MOS, he said, I'd like to go to medic. And so he actually went through medical training, which is for a lifer, you know, to go through a platoon with a bunch of recruits is a lot to ask. But he did. He went through this medical training and got himself taught correctly most of the stuff he already knew, and then he showed up in Vietnam as this medical sergeant, and he got his rank back. I mean, when he went back into the service, they gave him the same rank that he had had as a Marine for all these years, and so he started over. It was a pretty interesting guy. But he was kind of a misfit, I think, in the Army. I mean, he had more of a Marine attitude about him, and Marines are pretty gung-ho. So my relationship with him, me being this conscientious objector who barely squeaked by having to go to prison and then showing up without a weapon and with all my ideals, I don't know why, but he sort of took me under his wing. I think in the beginning he thought he could change me. I think that's probably what it was about, that I'll just whip this guy into shape and we'll slap the college off this guy real quick. And in the end, that's not necessarily what happened. So, but he's the central character of the book, and everyone who reads the book, you know, my editor spent a long time with, I have a wonderful woman who edits for me, who kind of changes my dangling modifiers and all the other stuff that I do. I write like I speak, and that's not always good for how it comes down in print, and she's really good about it, and she spent a lot of time, labor of love, over this thing. And at the end, we had published it, it had gone off, and we were waiting for the first copies of the book to come back after sending them off for publishing. It takes about 6 months, and I talked to her. I hadn't talked to her. I mean, we'd been talking all the time during the time she's editing, and so a couple months had gone by, and I hadn't talked to her, and I called her on the phone and said, how you doing anyway? I haven't talked to you in a long time. And she said, great. And I said, well, how are you feeling about things? And she said, I miss Smitty. Because she'd just gotten to know him so well in this book. And a lot of people have said that. They've said, yeah. And it's very interesting that the one huge hawk figure in this story written by a conscientious objector would be the one character that everybody really, really likes. But I like him too. He's a heck of a guy. Saved me a number of times.
Did you ever speak with him after your tour?
You know, the Army's a funny place. You come and you go. You get to know people really well, and then they get their orders for another camp, and you shake hands, you say goodbye, and say, we'll have to hook up sometime, and you never do. It's hard. It's hard. In fact, in the first book I wrote, first manuscript, I used his real name, and it was the only real name I used in the whole book. I put it out there on purpose because I wanted to find him. And I thought if he'd read this book, or anybody else who knew him would read it, Maybe I could find him. He's about 12 years older than me, which would put him almost 70 now. And he was a chain smoker. And I don't know too many people who live past 60 if they smoke all the time. So there's a good chance he's not with us. But yeah, I'd love to run into him again. When the Random House book came out, they, of course, changed every name in it. So it couldn't be anywhere, not even close to the original person. So I figure there were enough Smiths in the army and enough people called Smitty that I would keep that. That was his last name, was Smitty, but the first names were changed for liability purposes and all. Yeah, I'd love to run into him. I have this fantasy, I'm sitting on Oprah and talking about my book, and she somehow has found him, and out he comes. Yeah. First thing he'd do is probably slap me and tell me I got something wrong in the book. But
you said earlier that the war in Vietnam, the war that you were in there, was a sniper war, and that there were command detonated mines.
Mm-hmm.
Again, with our current situation in Iraq, that seems to describe that situation.
Yeah, and I'm not too sure because I don't study the war that much. It just angers me so much that I can only take so much of it. But what I understand is that some of what is being used against us is ammunition dumps we left behind when we had to pull back. I mean, we went in thinking we were going to take this whole country over and set up all these strategic points, and then we were run off of them. And so here they've got now, they're bombing us with our own stuff. But what the name that they used for it is something like a handmade device or something. I could look on my list of war dead and see what it's called. But what it means in essence is somebody has taken pieces and put them together and made a bomb out of them. And so that with the suicide bombings, but a lot of this is just putting pieces together and sitting a bomb out there, and then either something rolls over it and explodes it, or somebody's triggering it with a on command. When they see you right in the right position, they're triggering a bomb to go off. And with technology nowadays, that's not that hard to do. Technology is a lot more advanced than it was when I was in Vietnam, so they actually would have to get close enough to the command detonated mine that they could twist this electrical charge in their hand connected by wires. So when we got blown up, there was somebody pretty close to us. And then they would scoot off and get into a tunnel or do whatever. That was why we walked so far apart. Part of the reason you go through the jungle with yards between you and the next guy is you want to be close enough where you can see him and the guy in front of you and behind you, but you don't want to be close to them, because if people bunch up and you walk by a mine, that would be the time to release the mine to get as many as you can with one shot. When I see movies of war movies, and I see them walking too close together, my wife always laughs at me because I'm in my seat just squirming. And she's saying, you're doing it again. And it's always because they're walking too close. And I say, they got to get apart. She says, it's a movie. Leave it alone. They had a camera shot. Yeah, but it's wrong. It's just wrong.
So watching movies can be tough for you at times.
Yeah. Well, in the early days, I remember, Deer Hunter came out, and it was one of the first that had anything about Vietnam in it. I don't necessarily think that the Deer Hunter, the Russian roulette game, and all that kind of stuff is, I'm not sure how close to reality that is for anything that really happened. But the Deer Hunter movie, I was at this Polish wedding in the movie, everybody dancing around, and then the next thing we were in helicopters and blasting away, and I'm in a war zone with all the noise. And part of your memory, two things will bring your memory back like nothing else, even more than visual, and that is the sound and the smell. When I'm behind a bus and smell diesel fuel, a lot of Vietnam comes back to me. Like if I'm on a layover in an airport and want to just snooze, I can't go to sleep in an airport because there's a faint enough diesel smell to the airport that if I go to sleep and dream with that diesel fuel in my head, it's not good. It's not a good thing at all. So I will never, ever sleep in an airport or on a plane for that matter. It's just a faint enough smell that comes in on people's clothes and stuff from the airport smell of jet fuel and all those diesel vehicles running around. But those memories, yeah, things will trigger memories. I guess that's what I was trying to answer. Oh, I know what I was talking about. Sorry, I lost it there for a minute. I was talking about Deer Hunter. When all of a sudden this battle started, I was at the premiere of Deer Hunter at the Big Fox Theater downtown in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, in Westwood. And that theater is configured in a way that all of the audience is in the middle and the aisles are on the left and the right. And there are maybe 30 or 40 seats wide. And we were right down in the middle, about the seventh row back. And I somehow got from my seat out into the parking lot on my hands and knees without knowing how I got there. I must have just crawled right over people's laps. But I was in the middle. I mean, there were at least 20 people between me and the aisle. And all I remember is being in a Polish wedding in this movie. And the next thing, my girlfriend patting me on the back as I was on my hands and knees out in the parking lot. That's the next thing I remember. And so I saw Deer Hunter, the movie Deer Hunter, 10 years later, when I finally sat down with friends and said, okay, what happened? Where did this movie go? And then I didn't really like the movie all that much, but that's how shocking it was. It hit me at a time when... And so by the time Platoon came out, I knew what Platoon was about, and I knew that it was written and directed by a Vietnam vet. So I went to Platoon thinking... In the meantime, I saw Apocalypse Now, and I didn't think it had anything to do with Vietnam at all. But I saw the whole movie. The boat scenes were pretty authentic, and the Martin Sheen thing of being out in the heat, and the, although nobody would be playing rock and roll music running down a river and being exposed out there where snipers can hit you. That's not how we did it. We did it huddled behind armored boats, afraid at any moment that anybody could shoot us. So that part was a little weird. But when I saw Platoon, I went fully expecting it to be an authentic look at Vietnam. And I liked the Oliver Stone treatment. I thought the plot was probably a little contrived in that this thing between sort of the alcohol drinkers and the dope smokers, that was a little contrived. Although, and maybe Oliver Stone took a little liberty there, I wasn't in that kind of a platoon. That wasn't an issue for us. As a medic, I wasn't going to let anybody smoke anything or drink anything when we were out in the field. And we were on long missions, but that wasn't going to happen. Not in our platoon anyway. That's just taking everybody's life in jeopardy. And so I thought that was a little loosey-goosey in Platoon. But boy, the scenes, the way he looked through that camera and gave you the fear of walking in the dark at night and seeing people coming through the jungle and all that, boy, he really had it. I sat in that movie going, yeah. And you notice nowhere in Platoon do people march anywhere close to each other as they're going through the jungle. They're like way spread out. And so all the really authentic stuff, I thought that Oliver just did an incredible job with that movie. If somebody wants to know what Vietnam was like, that's the movie to see. Plot aside and personalities aside, that's the one to see.
One of the items in your book that stuck out for me on the first read was a term, D-O-W, died of wounds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what that is?
Well, died of wounds is an official... You have KIA, killed in action. You have MIA, missing in action. And you have died of wounds, which means someone was in the hospital later and died of wounds that they had. So the died of wounds is a statistic. What happened in Vietnam was that the press back home was every night reporting the casualties for that day. Well, they chose to report only the KIA. They didn't report any missing in action, and they didn't report any died of wounds. And their philosophy behind that was, and this has been written a lot about, I mean, people who were in the media in those days give reasons why this was so. They did it because an MIA could show up the next day or could just be somewhere else and might not have been captured or be a POW. There's another three-letter thing. Everything has three letters. A died of wounds could be someone who had been in the hospital for months. So to give the listeners, the viewers, an accurate description of what was going on in the war that day, to add a died of wounds to the numbers of KIAs of that particular day would give them not a real look at what was happening score-wise in the war that day. So all they reported was KIA. They didn't report DOW. Well, technically, a person has to be dead on arrival. There's another three letters, DOA, dead on arrival. They have to be dead on arrival to be a KIA. So with you've got helicopters out in the field bringing people back in to surgical hospitals, and I was at a surgical evac hospital out in the field, and the part in my book that talks about this is that here these helicopters came and they had bodies with them, and the bodies were ambulatory people who were walking wounded, people on stretchers who were critically wounded, people who were dead already. And as the stretchers came off the helicopters, there was a little sort of a sorting area, a triage, if you will, that we were, my job, standing there at the beginning when I was in this evac hospital. We'd come off of an evac helicopter and they needed more help, and they said, just stand here and send the people who need the immediate help over this direction and get the ambulatories over here so we can get some medics to help them or someone else to help them. And if someone's dead, you got to make that determination right then. If they can't be helped or can't be revived, if they're just gone, then that is a KIA and send them over this direction. Well, somebody's counting all that. When I got back into the tent where the doctors were, the doctors had been given orders that if anybody comes into the tent who is critically wounded but is not dead, if they're still alive in any way, then they will be listed as a DOW if they later expire. Even if they're really critical and the doctors lose them in 5 minutes, that won't be a KIA, that will be a DOW. So there you have it. So then the news that goes back to America to be read at night only contains the ones who were technically called killed in action, not the ones who were called died of wounds. Well, we had helicopters getting people back to the hospitals within sometimes 15 minutes. And we had a whole lot of people who arrived still alive who died within the first half hour or hour. And those were not included in the nightly news. When people talk about media and about choosing statistics and what they choose to share with you and what they don't choose to share with you, there's just one more evidence of how what the media wanted was for one reason, what the Army wanted to tell them was for a whole different reason, and it was just manipulated numbers.
Reading something like that made me question even more the information we're getting out of Iraq.
Well, yeah, we're just born to question. I don't know. I don't trust it. I know that when I was in Vietnam, General Westmoreland had asked for numbers, and he wanted to tell Lyndon Johnson that we were winning this war. And if you ever added up how many Vietnamese we killed in Vietnam War, we killed every man, woman, and child about 4 times. And then there was this whole myth about, well, they're sending all these Chinese people down to Vietnam to fight the war. That's not even true. The communist Chinese did not participate in the war. And then there was myths about insurgents or militants coming over from Cambodia or Laos or even Thailand and being mercenaries. It's just not true. It just didn't happen. So if you go back and add up the numbers and what the population of Vietnam was, and you say how many we lost, 58,000 something, and how many they lost, you know, millions, when you start adding up all of the numbers that came back, it just doesn't figure. It just doesn't work. So what the bottom line is, Westmoreland wanted to tell Johnson, and later Abrams wanted to tell Nixon, that we were winning the war. And so every time we crossed a river, somebody called a kill in. You know, it just make them happy, make the generals happy, make the colonels happy, call in kills. If you saw something move and shot at it and it didn't move again, call it in.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Ben Sherman. He is author of the book Medic, the story of a conscientious objector in the Vietnam War. At what point after you had written your first run on your book, when did you start getting involved with other groups here to talk about your experiences and or current policy?
A year and a half ago, before the Iraq War. I've never been in a protest in my life, never joined any group, came back from Vietnam, didn't talk about it with anybody, didn't tell anybody I was a conscientious objector. Even when people were still protesting the war, when I came back, I stayed away, to me, the protests were more like a love-in. You know, they were just all part of the 60s and the 70s and people going down there and gathering because it was the thing to do and the place to be. I didn't think that people in their heart had the conviction. I wasn't pro-war in any way. I wasn't trying to protect my fellow soldiers or something from the protests and all. But I didn't participate in anything. I didn't participate during the Desert Storm thing. You know, I mean, I vote every time, but I was never involved. And this Iraq war, to me, from the very beginning, was so different, was so much more like Vietnam than it was like anything else we'd experienced. The Desert Storm thing ended quickly. It didn't continue back down into Baghdad. We pushed people out of Kuwait. We, in essence, took an elephant gun and, you know, shot a mouse with it. We did so much so quickly, so fast, and the army was left alone to do their job. Storm and Norman Schwarzkopf and his army very quickly were able to dispatch an enemy back out of Kuwait and back. That was what was in people's minds when this Iraq thing started. And to take over a whole country is a lot different than pushing an occupying force out of an occupied country. To take over an entire country, going into it, I just thought, this is just sick and wrong. They have no idea what they're getting into here, and I didn't see any kind of policy or strategy or exit strategy. I just, the more I heard, and this business of not trusting the words of the UN weapons inspectors who'd been there a lot, not trusting people, diplomats who'd been in the country a long time, agreeing with people that Saddam Hussein was a terrible dictator, but looking at a world where there were terrible dictators all over the place. We're not doing anything about Sudan, and what's going on there is just atrocious. I just smelled a rat, and I got involved. I got involved with the, saw a person at a table out in front of the bookstore where I live, and they were signing people up for a peacemakers group, and I gave them $10 and said, yeah, put my name in the newspaper. I think this war's wrong. And that was like my first act ever of being against something in a protest way. And then I got involved with this veterans group and saw that here were people, a lot of people just like me, who have been to war, who know what goes on in a war, who are not in any way anti-American or unpatriotic. In fact, it was one of the most patriotic groups you want to find. But who say part of being patriotic and loving your country is standing up, like Teddy Roosevelt said, when the president is not doing what is in the best interest of the people, that it's up to the people to stand up and stop him. I mean, that was said by a sitting president. And he was challenging people that if you don't like my policies and don't like what I'm doing, then it is your responsibility, not just your right, but your responsibility to bring that to my attention. Otherwise, I'm a dictator. And I mean, that comes from a sitting president. And that's a very patriotic idea, is to stand up and say, you are not doing these things for the right reasons, and you're not doing it in my name as, quote, we the people. I mean, you're not, this is wrong for we the people. And I feel extremely patriotic in doing that. Even more so because I'm a person who has seen a war firsthand. And the people who planned and plotted this war have not. And they frankly don't know what they're talking about. And they don't know what they're doing. Between you and me and everyone listening, I just don't think they know what they're doing. I don't think they had a strategy in the first place. They had an anger. They had a plan about a whole area. I think it comes from a very, very narrow view of the world. I think it comes from a religiously bigoted look at the world. I think they truly believe that every Muslim everywhere hates us. I think they're unwilling to say that, but I think that's what they believe. I think their ideas are backward. I think they represent America when all of America should not be represented in that way. I think they represent Christianity when all Christianity should not be represented that way. I think they represent a very narrow, fundamentalist, Armageddon fear-based view of a very small group of Christians who believe that even if the world comes to an end, that Jesus himself will come down and pick them up and all their friends and take them to the kingdom in the sky. Although that is a part of the Christian belief system, it is a very, very narrow, radical view to believe that we humans will have anything to do with that whatsoever. That Armageddon will happen when God wants it to happen, not when we force it. And I just think it's that we don't really get how bad it's gone. He doesn't even represent Republicans. There are lots of really good Republicans out there who come from... He doesn't represent conservatives. He's not conservative when it comes to economy or ecology. I mean, why would a conservative give tax breaks, especially to people who already have money? That's not a conservative economic policy. Why would a conservative destroy the land to seek oil? A conservative wouldn't do that, not the Republicans, conservatives I know. I was raised by two Republicans, and I'm offended by what a small, very narrow group of right-wing religious, what I would call zealots, have done to dishonor the Republican Party. And it's only because the entire middle has shifted so far to the right that they can even get away with it.
So now you are going out using your book and talking with groups like high school students?
Yeah, I've been invited to high schools. They invite me to talk about Vietnam. They want to talk about Iraq. They want to talk about what's going on now with their war, and I don't mind doing that. I take with me a scroll of the dead to roll out across the front row of the class. It used to roll out. Now it goes wall to wall and a little further. I take pictures of dead soldiers, show the students so they can take one home each. So I talk a little bit about Vietnam, talk a little bit about war, and then when they want to talk about Iraq, I roll this thing out, and then I stop talking. I try to keep my part to 20 minutes or less, because I'm usually there either 50 or 90 minutes, and I really want to hear what they have to say. And I've heard some incredible things from students. They are a lot more with it than we would guess. And they ask very real questions about the whole solving of international problems. And they want to know things. And they're studying this stuff. And the teachers are trying to get them to go and do their book learning to back up what their things are. But boy, this generation just moves so fast. You know, they get on the internet and they see three things and they've decided what their whole life philosophy is. And then the next day they see three more things, and that changes, of course. But I'm very impressed with how I'm not bringing any information to them. I know better than that. The information is free. It's out there. They can get it anywhere they want to. And they've got so much more information running around in their heads, and they can remember so much more than I can, that I'm really just kind of catalyzing a conversation. They get to talk to somebody who was in a real war. So that's important. They like to do that. They like to see it in real terms rather than just print on a page somewhere, and that generates some pretty good conversations. I've been to some interesting places, inner city, urban Seattle High School, Mercer Island High School, SQUIM. Did high schools out in SQUIM were much more pro-military out there. So I'm liking it. I'll go anywhere anybody invites me. It's great stuff. And I also recommend that they, you know, for next fall, the people who are asking me to come next fall, I'm asking them to use my book as a supplementary reading first, because it reads real fast. It's pretty cheap. The book's $7 a piece, and they can get it for a lot. They probably get about 40% off if they buy it directly from Random House. So it's a book that's inexpensive. They can buy a classroom set and then pass it out, and the students seem to read this thing really fast. So young people, 17, 18-year-olds, can read it in a day and a half. You know? So that means that when they come back to the class, they have a discussion that involves everybody. One of the history teachers told me that this first time ever in his whole 18-whatever years of teaching that he has had a whole class read an assignment, literally overnight and come in wanting to talk about it then rather than waiting a week until I was going to arrive. They wanted it right then. He said, I had to put them off for a whole week and say, no, we're going to talk about this because the author's coming. And they were like, to heck with the author. We want to talk about it now. So that's a good sign that it's a good read and it's a fast read. It's easy read. And they were kind of the target in my writing, was I wanted to get this out to the draftable ages, you know.
There's a Chinese curse of what I've heard called may you live in interesting times, which I think we do in a very graphic way. And I heard you speak the other night here at the University Bookstore, and you talked about that your life had a certain degree of synchronicity, and you had used an example of the way a photo of you mm-hmm. landed on the cover of your book. Mm-hmm. It was completely, on some levels, by chance. I'm wondering if you feel that synchronicity and your own sense of hope maybe for solving our world's problems are aligning here, because in some ways we're looking at the current conflict in Iraq. We can't keep having conflicts like this with the level of weapons that we have now. I guess I'm getting at, I'm wondering if you are hopeful that we might be at a turning point in terms of a species and a civilization.
Well, one would hope. I wrote a note to my daughter when she was born and put it in a suitcase for her to open when she left to college. And I kept putting things in there for about the first 10 years of her life, her little package. And one of the things that I wrote in there in 1985 when Amy was born was, in that note, was that I hoped that by the time that she got to college, that the concept of war was old and retired, and that we had, that not that we didn't disagree with people, but that we had found another way to solve our disagreements rather than weapons and killing and mass killing and war. And that I think I said in the letter, I want you to think about war the way I think about cannibalism or something else that's just so weird. But, you know, cannibalism isn't that old. I mean, it was still around just, you know, a couple, two, three generations ago. But nowadays, you know, you think, oh my gosh, you know, how ridiculous. How could anybody eat another human being, you know? Well, I'd like it to be ridiculous. I would love that to happen. Well, she's a freshman in college now, and my prediction was wrong. My hope didn't happen. In some ways, I just feel like a terrible failure in this generation, that we just haven't learned anything. And I'm willing to be a failure tomorrow again and just keep going out and failing every day. But I do feel a lot like we haven't learned the lesson we were sent here to learn. Now, I have some pretty mystic friends who talk about the age of Aquarius and the turning and the flipping of the polars and all the polar caps and all that stuff. But I feel inside me that we certainly have the potential. Robert Mueller, when he came and spoke to a group here in Seattle right after the Iraq War started and right after all the protests happened all over the world, this bright light came in, and here he was talking to peace activists who, of course, were just down in the dumps, because here they'd been out on the street and they'd done their signs and they'd written their letters and they'd been on phone banks to senators and they'd done everything they could to avoid this thing happening, and they felt like, it's just such a stupid thing, why are we doing this? And then here we went, there were the bombs, they just went ahead and did it. And so all of us were just feeling terribly depressed. And he came in saying, isn't this a great day? Isn't this an astonishing revelation for us as Americans? And we were like, what? Are you nuts? And he said, for the first time in the history of mankind, we have the entire world in a dialogue about peace. And everyone just kind of took a breath. And then he said, now, we need to be sure that we keep America, the United States of America, in that dialogue. Because right now, the rest of the world doesn't think we're in that dialogue. They're thinking that we all are behind this warfare thing. So we have to be sure to do our part. But whether we want it or not, the whole rest of the world right now is talking about peaceful solutions. So there's hope. There's hope. Someone told me once that George W. prays every night and that he asks God for his guidance. Well, I think, what if? What if there is a God? What if there's a great creator who is saying, okay, George, I'm going to use you to once and for all and finally get humankind to reject the notion of war. And so do what I tell you. I mean, well, there's a concept. He's using him and using him hard. If you're a religious person, that can give you the shivers, you know, to think, but if you go back to your Old Testament or the Quran and read the way those people thought the Creator actually worked, how the Great Spirit worked, there's some pretty bad stuff in there. I mean, this is a Creator that works with hurricanes and tornadoes and great floods, and you know, when he wants to get your attention, look out. And I think the synchronicity thing that I was talking about the other night is a gentler aha. When the Creator or the creation sets up things so that you are reminded, and I'm reminded by synchronicities. I'm reminded when one and two and three and four synchronicities at four different levels happen around the same subject. And it's like I'm being beaten in the temple, you know, something smacking me saying, will you please pay attention today? I'm giving you all these signs. Will you please pay attention? I think, yeah, okay. What was it again I was supposed to be paying attention? Please remind me. But it doesn't take long to just back up a little, look at the landscape and say, oh, okay. I'm being reminded that these are the things that are important to do. And I don't need to be angry to do them. I don't need to be excited to do them. I need to get up every morning and take a big breath and do the right things that day. And that if I do, I will be taken care of. And if we all do, we will move toward what promises to be a much better solution than those solutions that we have so far. And that we shouldn't be depressed about it. We should have hope about it. The way Robert Mueller said to us, don't be depressed. Here you see that maybe you don't have control over this. Maybe you aren't supposed to have. Maybe you're supposed to be in a more chaotic environment at this particular time in order to bring order later. It has to be stirred. And we have to get your attention again. You were being too complacent. And so now we're getting your attention big time. And getting the whole world's attention. There are a lot of nations out there who have been making decisions about who they are and what they are based upon what America has done. Interesting. The UN all of a sudden became way more important. Interesting. Not complacent anymore, that's for sure. Anyway.
We've just been talking with Ben Sherman. He is author of the book Medic, the story of a conscientious objector in the Vietnam War.